From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Bush administration has announced plans to install a U.S. military-run administration in Iraq after a war. The plan is part of what is reportedly a sweeping vision to democratize the entire Middle East. But Iraqi opposition leaders are frustrated, feeling pushed aside at the very point they've been waiting for years, the chance to run a more democratic Iraq themselves. Tonight on Point, planning for a post-war Iraq. We begin tonight in London, where British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced that he will travel to the Vatican on Saturday for an audience with the Pope. It comes on the heels of a rare joint statement against an Iraq war made yesterday by heads of both the Anglican and British Roman Catholic churches. Stephen Bates is religion correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. I asked him what Tony Blair could be hoping for from this papal meeting.
Well, I think it's going to be pretty much a courtesy call, although it is actually a historic occasion because no British Prime Minister has ever met a Pope before. And so there's that element of novelty to it. I think in the current circumstances, of course, with the Pope having loudly and repeatedly voiced his opposition to any war in Iraq, it's going to have a certain degree of spikiness to it because Mr. Blair, certainly in the last week or so, has been raising the profile of the case for war on a moral basis, which, of course, hits right at the church's concerns about what's going on, both churches on your side of the Atlantic and ours.
And also, we know that Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz met with the Pope last Friday. Any idea of what he heard or what he said?
Well, I gather the Pope told him, as he's told previous contacts the Vatican's had with the Iraqi administration, that they must comply immediately and fully with all UN instructions and injunctions. And Tariq Aziz obviously got quite a propaganda coup from visiting the Vatican, and maybe he heard things that he didn't quite want to hear.
How do you read these meetings, then? Is the Vatican mostly being polite, do you think, or wanting to play a more active role?
I'm sure the Vatican wants to play a more active role, and this is a high-profile pope who's never been a retreating violet, as it were, in the face of the media or in face of world events. He's wanted to make his voice and his distinctively Catholic voice heard on issues of peace and war, and I'm sure he will welcome the opportunity to meet Prime Minister Blair.
And now today there was the release of an unusual joint statement from Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Cormac Murphy O'Connor, the Archbishop of Westminster. What prompted that?
Again, here the churches have taken quite a high profile in opposing the march to war in Iraq. They've been very outspoken. Both the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, and Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who's the leader of the Catholic Church here, have said that they don't think the principles for a just war have been met. They don't agree that there is a moral case yet for the war, as the Prime Minister has said, and they're insisting that every last step must be taken along the line of the UN route to avoid a conflict if it's at all possible. Their statement also said, of course, that they would be praying for political leaders as they take the burden of responsibility of making a final decision on this.
They're saying they want to avoid war if possible. Do you find any support for military action in that statement?
No. The church's position has never been an entirely pacifist one, and it's not certainly saying, indeed they went out of their way to say that this was not saying do nothing over Iraq. It was saying do everything to avoid war and explore every avenue before you go down that route. And that's something that chimes in very well with what the churches, the mainstream churches, have been saying in the United States, although they haven't had the opportunity to speak to President Bush about this. We had a delegation of fairly high-powered American church leaders in Britain who had an hour with Tony Blair at the Prime Minister's office in Downing Street earlier in the week. They were saying they've been and spoken to political leaders across Europe, and they've requested a meeting for the last month with President Bush, and they've had no answer whatsoever from the White House. So they were actually quite pleased that they got the chance to put the moral case against a conflict to Tony Blair.
And at the same time that we're seeing hundreds of thousands of people marching in London for peace, Mr. Blair is going around making his case for war on several occasions during the Commons question time last week and also during the Labour Party spring conference last weekend. Is he meeting with any success? Is he changing any minds?
The opinion polls don't show it. I think the opinion polls register that in midterm, all administrations become less popular, but there is really no sizable community in favor of war here. It is almost universally hostile to the idea of going to war, and people do say that they haven't seen Mr. Blair make the case, either a moral or a political or a military case for going to war, because they can't see what the outcome would be that would be more favorable and less dangerous than the current circumstances already are.
And how does this play out in terms of the Labour Party itself? How many voters are Catholic?
The Labour Party traditionally has had quite a high constituency of Catholic voters. For the old working class, the old Irish working class here, deep roots within both the Labour Party, and the Labour Party also has deep nonconformist roots within churches such as the Methodists and the Baptists, who were equally strongly against the war this time. So that religious constituency is very firmly against the war. The secular side of the Labour Party, which is by far the most strong these days, is also deeply split but largely hostile to the war. They are not convinced that the administration here has made the case either.
It does make you wonder, if Blair himself is not Catholic, which he isn't, why would he want to go and meet with a Pope who he already knows is against the war?
I think that's one of the things these leaders do, isn't it? Actually, Blair, who, as you say rightly, is not a Catholic, is married to a very devout Catholic. His children are being brought up as Catholic. In fact, he's probably the most Catholic political leader there's ever been in Britain. As you know, we have a certain spikiness since the Reformation 400 years ago between the Catholic Church and the Church of England. And traditionally, prime ministers have never been Catholic. They've always come from the Protestant denominations. He is also, it has to be said, the most religiously active and interested politician in religious matters that Britain has had probably since the days of Mr. Gladstone in the 19th century. So we've got a man there who is deeply concerned about religious matters and can't be comfortable that the churches are so uniformly hostile to him.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Stephen Bates is the religion correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. He spoke with us earlier from London. U.S. officials are burying the idea of supporting a provisional government of Iraqi exiles in a post-Saddam era and have opted instead to install a U.S. military-run administration in Iraq after a war. That plan, unveiled at a meeting in Ankara, Turkey last week, left Iraqi opposition leaders poised to run their country their way in a huff. It's a rocky start to the Bush administration's reported grand scheme to change the political landscape throughout the Arab world. That vision is to hasten the construction of civil society and eradicate terrorist groups. Well, that's the Pentagon's plan for a post-war Iraq. What kind of plan would you like to see? What should the United States' role be in Iraq after Saddam is gone? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now on the line is Nicholas Lemon, a writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of a recent letter from Washington entitled After Iraq. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. And thanks so much for joining us and for your very illuminating article, too.
Thank you.
So give us the broad strokes here. What is the Pentagon's post-war plan?
Let me first stop you and say, in this article, I quoted a couple of Pentagon officials. The Pentagon is a very big piece of cement and steel, so I don't want to ascribe one point of view to the entire place. But there is a sort of a scenario floating around, particularly among the hawks, both at the Pentagon, at the National Security Council, in the State Department, outside of government. And that would be that the war in Iraq would be the start of a real transformation, a regional transformation of the Middle East or of the Arab world. And the word that's used, although I'm sure we'll talk about this more precisely, to describe the transformation is democracy. In other words, this would be the beginning of a process of democratizing the entire Middle East, which is a rather big project.
To say the least. Well, let me ask you this. How likely is it for any plan to work if the reality and the perception is that it's the United States that's calling all the shots and only a polite nod to the Iraqis?
Well, you know, I think that this is a lot of complexities and twists and turns. The U.S. occupation is actually a victory within Washington for the doves over the hawks. And it could be argued that it would be more likely to produce something that would look to Americans like a democracy. In other words, the Iraqi opposition groups, if you didn't have a U.S. occupation, what you would have instead, I mean, no matter what you think of the Iraqi opposition groups, you'd have a small group of people being sort of, the U.S. Army would and Air Force and Marines and Navy would go in and conquer the country, and then they'd kind of say to the Iraqi opposition, particularly the Iraqi National Congress, here's the keys to the car, you take over. So it's not really as if the entire people of the country have established democratic institutions and chosen these folks. It's more like they've been installed in power by the United States government. You could argue that the longer the U.S. is in there and the more slowly the process of selecting a new government goes, the more democratic it could be.
Let's step back for just a moment, and I wonder if you could help us remember what the post-war military model for Germany and Japan looked like. Is that really what we're talking about here?
Well, nobody really knows, and it has often been pointed out that Germany and Japan were very different kinds of societies and kinds of nations from Iraq today. The big question is, what kind of society are we going to find when we go in and essentially take over? How much does it look like Yugoslavia did after the fall of Tito? In other words, do the three major ethnic groups there hate each other? If so, how much? Are they willing to make a nation together peacefully? When you get down one level below that, do you find it to be a country of tribal chieftains or of sort of modern democratic institutions? And then on the American side, the question is, how willing are the American people to pay for a lengthy, expensive occupation reconstruction of Iraq? They were very willing to pay a big, big, big price and have a lot of staying power in Germany and Japan. They weren't tested on that front. We weren't tested on that front in Afghanistan. So that's another big question is just, are we willing to stay as long as we've stayed in Germany and Japan? I mean, we're still in Germany and Japan.
Exactly. And I guess the other question is, how do you make sure that if you're there, that you're seen not as oppressors, but as liberators?
Well, that's an almost religious question, since we were just talking about religion. The hawks in Washington, and, we'll find out who's right the day after the war's over. The hawks really, really, really sincerely believe that, the American troops, when they come into Baghdad, will be cheered the way the American troops were cheered in Paris when Paris was liberated in 1945.
Is that at all likely?
I have no idea. I've never been to Iraq. I cover Washington. You're going to have to get somebody who knows Iraq better than I do to answer that question.
But do you think their optimism, do they feel that they have reason for that optimism, or are they just being optimistic?
No, they feel they have reason. I mean, I'll give you their argument. I mean, first of all, the hawks in government and the Iraqi...
I'm sorry, Nick. It's such a good question. It's such an important point that we want to make, and we're going to need to take a break. So hold the thought, and we'll be back. We're discussing plans for a post-war Iraq. What do you remember of U.S. post-war involvement in World War II? Do those models apply to the Middle East? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We've been talking about the scenario for a post-war Iraq. Is the Bush administration overly optimistic about bringing democracy to the Arab world? Is it the United States' job to bring democracy there? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Nicholas Lemon, who writes for The New Yorker magazine and is the author of a recent letter from Washington entitled After Iraq. And, Nick, we had to cut you short to take that break. But let's get back to this question about whether there are good reason for the Hawks to be optimistic.
Well, let's take you into their world. The Hawks, as far as I can tell, are totally sincere, but, you know, very optimistic. They don't spend a lot of time in Iraq either. They do spend a lot of time talking to the Iraqi opposition, and they hear through them and through intelligence reports endless horror stories about how oppressive Saddam Hussein's regime is. So they believe totally that Saddam's regime is despised by all of the Iraqi people, and that they would tremendously welcome the country's being invaded and taken over by the United States, because they would view the U.S. as the folks who had liberated them from oppression. They're, if there's any sort of core belief among the Hawks, that's it. They really think that.
Well, also with us now is Janine Zachariah, who is Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and author of a recent article in The New Republic entitled Exiled. Hi, Janine.
Hi there, Gail.
Glad you could join us, too.
My pleasure.
We just were speculating a few moments ago about the post-war military model and how that played out in Germany and Japan.
Right.
What's your take on that?
Well, I think one of the ideas that at least the Iraqi opposition was hoping would take off is, as after World War II, the U.S. carried out a sort of denazification there, they were hoping to see a de-Baathification, the Baath Party being Saddam Hussein's party, a total clearing house of all the Baath Party members who have surrounded Saddam Hussein throughout his regime. And there's a bit of skepticism and worry that the model Pentagon planners are drumming up would not achieve that goal, that it would leave some people in power. The Pentagon has set up an office, what they're calling an Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, to coordinate a post-Saddam effort, and they've appointed a retired lieutenant general named Jay Garner to oversee a lot of the civil administration that would be necessary after a war is complete. Who's going to run the fire department? Who's going to run the health services? How are they going to ensure that food gets to the people? And he is going to be transferred with the people that he's working with after the military operations cease to the region, and will work in coordination with the head of U.S. Central Command, Tommy Franks, who is leading the war effort.
So clearly you've got some daunting logistics there. And by the way, I want to apologize. I mangled your name.
It's okay. It happens all the time. Don't
Zachariah. Okay. Sorry, Janine. The logistical problem is on the ground. You've been writing a lot lately about the opposition leaders being squeezed out by the Bush administration. Are they in a position to handle those kind of logistics?
Well, I think that many in the Bush administration feel that they are not, because they've historically been not together. They've been divided on many issues. But I think that very much across the board, that the administration is going to want to transfer power to Iraqis as soon as possible, as soon as they can achieve a couple of key goals, which include foremost, seizing control of all the weapons of mass destruction that we've been hearing about. They want to take control of that, and that's something that they see as a U.S. military effort first. They have to secure borders. They have to secure the oil fields, probably repair the oil fields. And then once there's a little bit of stability there, somehow bringing Iraqis into the picture, into the governing picture. Now, the opposition groups, as Nicholas was pointing out, they would like to be a part of this right now. Take someone like Ahmed Shalabi, who's the head of the Iraqi National Congress. He's been championing the idea of regime change, just to give listeners a perspective, for years now, and he's very afraid of being left out of the action on the eve of war. Right now, he's in northern Iraq, which is protected by U.S. forces, trying to have a conference with other opposition leaders to perhaps form a provisional government. Now, this is an idea the U.S. government is very opposed to. They think it could undermine any effort as part of the war effort.
And is that something that's likely to happen? Because one of the other things we hear about is that there is no one clearly defined Iraqi opposition. There are lots of different groups who could fit under that heading.
Right. You have Sunni leaders. You have secular Shia like Ahmad Shalabi. You have Iranian-sponsored Shia groups, more religious-oriented groups. You have the Kurds. There are five or six kinds of groups who have managed to come together at different moments. You had a conference in December in London, which was pretty groundbreaking, where they were able to form a council of 65, come together, distribute seats to one another. And you had a senior U.S. representative, Zalmay Khalilzad, go there and sort of support them. This time, it's not clear whether Mr. Khalilzad is going to attend the conference. First of all, it keeps being postponed. It was supposed to be, it's four times or five times been postponed. Now they're talking about Monday. It's hard to get these things together. And a U.S. official told me just a short while ago that he would only go if they pledged not to declare this provisional government in exile. It just illustrates the tensions between the administrations and the exiles at this moment. In addition, just one last thing, you've had senior INC people like Ahmad Shalabi, like Kana Makia, writing articles this week complaining about the U.S. plan to have a military control over a couple of years. And that further shows the rifts between the groups and the U.S. government.
We're also hearing about Kurdish fighters being pushed aside. And I'm wondering whether that might be a little short-sighted, because it seemed to work well having the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan there on the ground to sort of show the way and be the people who knew the terrain.
Right. The Iraqi opposition has very much tried as a whole to fashion itself the Northern Alliance of Iraq. Hey, give us some really proactive military role in this. So far, Iraqi opposition leaders are being trained in Hungary for sort of advisory roles to serve as translators. You're going to have U.S. military personnel on the ground going into cities. They're not going to know which way is which city. They need people to guide them who speak the language. But specifically, in answer to your question, the Kurds who control two major Kurdish groups who control the north each have well over 15,000 troops who are willing to take part in this. And they have a couple problems with that. One is that it would make Turkey very nervous. I don't know what happens if Turkey doesn't join the coalition, but they don't want Kurdish fighters involved in this. And just frankly, the Pentagon, I think, Donald Rumsfeld, they have this idea that they want to go this alone. They want to do this with their people. They weren't totally pleased with the way it went with the Northern Alliance.
We want to go to our phone lines now. We have Marty on the line. Hi, Marty.
Good afternoon.
What's on your mind?
I think a lot of the Western leaders are deluding themselves. I believe that the population in a lot of the Middle East is perfectly willing to take all the tangible benefits the U.S. and other European nations will give them. I don't believe they have any great interest in what we call democracy. I think that I've forgotten the proper term for leadership or control by the strongest economic and political group, not a tyranny. I think it's oligarchy. And that's what they're most comfortable with. I think the average Arab Muslim person on the street, if you give him or her the ability to vote, will be very upset, very uncomfortable with it. As I think we have to realize that going in there, we're not going to be able to create a Western-style democracy because they don't think that way. They don't have an interest in it. A lot of the people are very interested, maybe 30%, 20%, but the bulk of the population wants nothing to do with what the West can offer except tangible financial benefits.
Marty, let's pose that question to Nick Lemon. Is Washington aware, you were speaking a moment ago about how important it is to have the support of the American people, particularly if we're going to be there for any length of time. Do you think Washington's aware of people like Marty and how they feel?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Marty is asking the right question. The national security strategy that the Bush administration published back in September, it's about 56 pages or something. It's a long document, but one line in there sticks in my mind, and that is, there is one system of government that is best for all people everywhere in the world, and it is the system we have, democracy. And President Bush said something along those lines in his State of the Union address in late January. In other words, the stated core belief of the administration is that democracy is right for all people in the world, and that and they believe this very forcefully, that and that includes the Middle East,
and past American policy was made on the basis of our caller's assumption that that part of the world really wasn't interested in democracy. And now the administration folks are saying, you know, that's an almost racist assumption. And in fact, people everywhere in the world want to live under democracy. And the experience in Eastern Europe and Latin America and Asia has proved that over the last 10 or 20 years. That's a super strong point of theirs. So if the caller is right, then the administration is wrong.
Janine, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. Maybe perhaps Marty's traveled through the region and talked to people about this. I just know from my travels to Egypt, to Jordan, to places like that, there is a very vibrant movement among people for to have freedom, to have human rights, to have maybe perhaps not Jeffersonian democracy, but certainly not to be ruled by a dictator. So I think that it's probably a fair assumption, at least, that people in the region who live in places like Saudi Arabia or...
Iran, even, there's some encouraging
Iran or
signs.
Or any country where there's no democracy there. So, I mean, would appreciate some freedoms that we have, like voting, something very basic like that. And yes, no doubt, the regimes enjoy the tangible benefits that he's referring to, aid packages and things like that, and the regimes are very uncomfortable by the notion of democracy because it could undermine their regime. But I agree that with the basic premise that that the administration is putting forth, that people would prefer to live in a free society than in a society ruled by a dictator who imprisons people and uses other measures to control them.
Let's go to John now. John's calling in. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you? Great program. I'm going to ask a question which I think is so difficult that I may get cut off. And the question is this. I think that many of us who... I was in New York last weekend for the peace demonstration there, and I think I've been to many demonstrations. There were huge numbers. I never saw anything like it. I don't even know if 400,000 is enough. But both of us who've done this think of three causes for this possible war. One is certainly an urge to, none is human rights, none is democracy. One is human rights, one is a drive for dominance, another is a drive for oil. And a third, which is absolutely taboo, is that this is a war, a proxy war for Israel. That Sharon and his government the Likudniks would dearly like this war, and many of the top advisors to the administration, Wolfowitz, Pearl, are former or present Israeli lobbyists. And I think that's something that this tail wagging the dog, this little power wagging a superpower for its own purposes, leading us into a disaster, is something we need to discuss because it's an important part of the equation. And I'd like to. I know your listeners, your guests are probably not going to like discussing this, but I'd like just for the heck of it to hear their response.
I would be happy to discuss it. Just a couple of points, if I could jump in here. First of all, on the human rights stuff, I want to again stress that they may be wrong, but the administration hawks truly, truly believe that. They are going to make life better in the Middle East by waging war there. I don't think they're being hypocritical. I think they believe that. On Israel, let me put it in a different and more complicated way. It is definitely true that a lot of the hawks in the administration are Jewish and are, you know, active, passionate Zionists. On the other hand, these are people, they're known loosely as neoconservatives. They've been very conservative for a good 30 years or more, and they have a well-developed worldview that is very hawkish. So I don't think, I mean, I know these people, and as I say, they may be right or they may be wrong, but they're not deceptive or insincere. I don't think they performed, and I don't think they were Israeli agents, as you say. They're you know, active supporters of Israel, but that's different from being agents of a foreign power. They don't perform the mental act of saying, I don't think this would be good for America, but it would be good for Israel, so therefore I'm for it. you know, that doesn't explain things like their support for Contra aid in Nicaragua back in the 80s. I mean, they're just very, very hawkish and support a very aggressive American military posture in every instance, not just instances of states that are close to Israel. I think their position is deeply rooted in the Jewish experience, particularly the Holocaust and the Zionist movement. But that's different from saying that these people are kind of fifth columnists, enemies of a foreign power, dual loyalists. I think that does them a disservice. I think they believe that the war in Iraq will be good for Israel, but they don't believe that's the reason to do it, and that they also think it'll be good for America. Final point, from what I hear anyway, rather than they're doing the bidding of Ariel Sharon, I think the American hawks are much more enthusiastic about this than anybody in Israel is, because, you know, they're right next door and they're going to get the spillover. So I definitely do not believe the view that Sharon is asking the United States to do this.
Janine, anything you'd like to add?
If I could, that'd be great. First, I'd like to direct the caller to an opinion piece in the Washington Post on Tuesday by Lawrence Kaplan called Toxic Talk on War, which mentions a lot of the points that Nicholas just made about how the hawks have a very expansive view on everything, not just about Iraq. First, about the question about the oil, I mean, the answer, a couple of things that people say about why perhaps it's not a drive for oil like many of the protesters believe. One is that Saddam Hussein is probably going to do a lot of damage to these oil fields, and experts are predicting that it will take several years and billions of dollars to get these oil fields back online. Another thing is that the U.S. really does not want to be perceived as conquerors. They know what the implications of that would be, and they'd be quite negative. So they're going to have to transfer control of the oil fields to the Iraqis probably as soon as possible, I think. And then American companies, like European companies and everybody else, can compete for contracts. And thirdly, if it was about oil, it'd be much more simple just to simply lift sanctions on Iraq and say, hey, let's go cash in and make deals with Saddam, rather than pursue this very expensive, costly war. Now, on the issue of Israel, I can tell you from personal experience, every time Prime Minister Sharon comes to Washington, and he's come about seven times, he'll be coming an eighth time next month, he sits down with the reporters from Israeli news organizations, and he talks about what he talked to President Bush about. And he didn't start with the Palestinian problem. He did talk about, but he didn't start with Iraq either. He would talk about Iran. So if it was purely an Israeli interest, I would say that the U.S. would be taking on Iran right now first, more than Iraq, because they feel much more threatened by Iran. And I think that Israel will benefit, though, but it's more of a byproduct than a motivation for this war.
We're talking about plans for a post-Saddam, post-war Iraq. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Bush administration's plans for a post-war Iraq. What do you remember of U.S. post-war involvement after World War II? Do those models apply to the Middle East? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Nicholas Lemon, who writes for the New Yorker magazine and is the author of the recent Letter from Washington, entitled After Iraq. And also with us is Janine Zakaria, Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and author of a recent article in the New Republic entitled Exiled. And right now we have joining us on the line from Washington, Intifad Kanbar. He is director of the Washington Office of the Iraqi National Congress. Welcome, Intifad.
Thank you very much.
You have been hoping to be declared as an official or perhaps even unofficial government in exile as recently as January. Any chance that's still in the cards?
Actually, that's not the case. We are against a government in exile. We are for an interim government, and a government in exile is not something workable, and I don't think it's wise, but we are in favor of an interim government, which we'd like to establish once there's a foothold of liberated soil in Iraq after the operation starts.
So it's not so much important to you what happens right now, it's after war if there is one.
No, but there are things has to be done to have the interim government ready, which is basically electing a leadership for the Iraqi opposition who will have the power to name this interim government at the right time and at the right place.
I'm not sure if I'm following the difference. It sounds as if you're talking about pretty much the same thing, just describing it differently.
We don't want to have a government without being on Iraqi soil. We want to have the structure. We want to have the understanding. We would have the people that could do this government, make it happen as soon as we have soil liberated in Iraq, but not in exile.
Okay, so the planning can happen now.
Absolutely.
Okay. Why do you think that there's this perception that you and other opposition leaders are being pushed aside?
Well, it's not a perception. It's true. Some agencies in Washington are not in favor of democracy in Iraq. And one of the ways to divert the issue from democracy and is this idea, the recent idea which was suggested of a military American general ruler of Iraq, with removing only the heads of the ministries in Iraq and keeping the whole structure as is, which is basically the closest scenario to those agencies who've been trying for years to have a coup in Iraq and keep everything as is. We call it Saddamism without Saddam.
Who are you saying in Iraq is not for democracy? In Washington.
Oh, CIA and the State Department, they have been consistently over the years against this idea, and that's why the CIA have been very much keen into the idea of a military coup in Iraq, and which has failed and basically awarded Saddam more than hurt Saddam.
Is there any chance you think that a post-war strategy can work without the very active involvement of Iraqis as being much more than advisors?
I think it doesn't make sense. It's unwise. I mean, could you have, for example, a military general redesigning the new flag of Iraq or writing down what is the new Islamic curriculum in the education system in Iraq? This is a huge, complicated country, and we are witnessing nowadays there is not much of understanding of the culture of Iraq within the Washington organizations, within the U.S. government. How could you hand such a complicated country to a U.S. general? Well, there are Iraqis who are smart enough, know what to do, and could work on it. However, I think the new interim government, or the Iraqis which will rule Iraq in this interim government, should become close allies with the United States. And the United States presence in Iraq will be useful to maintain Iraq's integrity and sovereignty, but should not interfere with the sovereignty of the Iraqi people on their own soil.
One of the problems seems to be here that there are many elements of the Iraqi opposition. Is there some way that all of you folks can get together and not be fighting among yourselves? Would that make it easier?
How did you, what did you come out of this conclusion? The last conference in London in December, we've proven and we have exceeded every expectations. We even exceeded expectations of the American delegation there. We sat down, we talked. People always work together when there is a goal, when there is no lack of policy. Now there is a policy, the United States, to remove Saddam, and it's helping us to unite. Every Iraqi opposition is united on two main principles: removal of Saddam and establishing democracy. Are we going to have differences on other issues? Of course, that's democracy. We don't have rubber stamps that we're going to stamp only one opinion that, like the Iraqi parliament. We're not willing to do that.
And how do you think those issues are going to sort themselves out?
By democracy, by discussion, by having a freedom of press, by people saying what they want, by giving rights to minority ethnic groups, by giving rights to the Shia, by giving rights to the Kurds. Not by oppressing people and giving them only one option to choose, otherwise they will be killed, like in Saddam's regime.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kanbar. We appreciate your joining us.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Intifad Kanbar is director of the Washington Office of the Iraqi National Congress. Nick, I want to go to you and get a response to what Intifad Kanbar was just telling us. Do you see any spirit in Washington that's not for democracy there?
I think he's being a little unfair. I mean, some backstory. This is a fight that's been going on for a really long time, depending on how you measure it, and well predating the Bush administration. The State Department and the CIA have tended to be right along down the line skeptical of the Iraqi National Congress, and at least in this administration, the Pentagon and the Vice President's office are much more supportive of the Iraqi National Congress. I think it's not fair to say the only argument the State and Department and the CIA have is that they oppose democracy. If you were to state their position, it would be that, you know, as we were just discussing, in the past, American military occupations of countries has led to genuine democracy. The United States doesn't want to and can't afford to just occupy Iraq and run it with American troops forever. So it's got to be turned over to some kind of government eventually. And after the chaos of war, they don't trust the Iraqi National Congress. They think this is a group of basically the economic elite of the country, the leadership, is the economic elite of the country that was kicked out when the Ba'ath Party took power in 1958. And, you know, they have many, many good reasons to despise Saddam Hussein, but they're not, they're suspected of being a Sunni displaced elite, not broadly representative of all forces in Iraq, and not, you know, ready to govern the country right now. The worry is that they would be given such a big head start if made a provisional government or a temporary government or government exile or anything like that, that you would have less likelihood of genuine democracy down the road. Now, the Iraqi National Congress may be right, but, you know, this is a bitter dispute that's been going on for many years, and it's not fair to say that the only possible reason to oppose them is that you don't believe in democracy.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. Knut is calling in from Janesville, Wisconsin. Hi, Knut.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not as informed and expert as the other speakers there, of course, but what I hope this is somewhat related. What I wanted to say was that Bush has stopped using the terms, it seems to me. Bush has stopped using the terms going to war, in war, and attack. He's used terms like keeping the peace. Well, Saddam is sort of put on parole as a result of the first conflict. So now it's more appropriately a police action, really. And if we were to see it as that, then, of course, it seems to me that would have some effect that would relate to the post Iraq scene there. And obviously there's a lot of interest in governing and thinking in Arab cultures, and it seems to me a police action would really support that, where a war or an attack suggests some different things. In Europe, they're using the word war. The church leaders, the intellectual leaders, and others are using the term war, and they have to avoid war above all things, etc. Again, it's because it's not seen as a police action, really.
We take your point, Knut. Thanks so much for the call. Janine, let me throw that one to you. How important is language in framing the arguments?
Well, they have been using some interesting phrases. I think the caller's right that keeping the peace refers to, obviously, after the war. I think it comes from this sort of post-9/11 mindset that the president is really deeply rooted in the president now, that he sees this as a mission that he has to do, that if he didn't do it, then there would be no peace because Iraq could potentially team up with terrorists like al-Qaeda, arm them with weapons of mass destruction, and use them against us or use them against our allies. And so that's what he means, I think, when he says keeping the peace. You hear other phrases like one which I haven't heard in the last week or two, but democratic regime, setting up a democratic regime in Iraq. That to me sounds oxymoronic. I'm not really sure what that means. If I could just add one thing to what we were saying before in response what the INC spokesman was saying. It was interesting that he changed the term. He said, we're not for provisional, we're for an interim government. I also thought that was sort of just a semantic shift, perhaps to accommodate the Americans. But another reason that the State Department believes that that the State Department would say, we are actually the defenders of democracy, the democratic ideal here, because if we just go in and impose an interim government that we have pre-selected, how is that democratic? And that's one of the arguments that they make in this ongoing dispute that Nicholas was describing between between the administration and the exiles.
Let's go to David, who's standing by on the line. Hi, David.
Yes, I agree with all of the reasons that people have suggested that we might be going to war, oil being chief among them, especially given Bush's and Cheney's history in and money invested in there. But one issue has surfaced from a source that essentially told me the real reason, an underlying reason, is in Saudi Arabia, there's the largest airfield in the world. It is owned by the U.S. military, and it is in jeopardy. The king is aging, and there's a good chance that when he's gone, his sons will throw America out. And I wanted to hear a comment on that. And also, harking back to the Kuwait war, I heard a rumor that we were in there, or excuse me, the Iraqis were in for 4 days in Kuwait, and the U.S. did nothing. At the same point in time, the Saudis came to us and said there are 120,000 Iraqis massing on the border of Saudi Arabia. We want your help, when in fact it was really only some 2,000 Iraqis who had displaced 28 or so executives in Kuwait. And then it was meet the new boss, same as the old boss, as far as everybody else in Kuwait was concerned. And I'd like to hear the comments on that, on those two issues.
All right. Thanks for the call, David. Nick or Janine, you want to take a run at that?
Well, just quickly, let me try to sort of tie everything together into a neat package. Those within the administration who favor the war in Iraq, I think part of the motivation is that it would be a way of creating more distance between the United States and Saudi Arabia, that they're uncomfortable with the idea that we are dependent on Saudi Arabia for oil and for our military basing privileges, and therefore, you know, we have to sort of let them get away with stuff that they shouldn't be allowed to get away with, such as the charities that end up sending money into the hands of terrorists. After the war, we would be much less dependent because presumably we would have a nearby country, Iraq, that would be a source of oil and a place to put a military base. So therefore, we could sort of take a tougher line with the Saudis, and I think that's part of the broader regional strategic appeal of this war.
Well, I would say you wrapped it up very nicely for us. Nick Lemon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nick is a writer for The New Yorker magazine and also author of a recent article entitled After Iraq. And also, my thanks to Janine Zakaria. Hope I got it right that time, Janine. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Janine is Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and also author of a recent article in The New Republic entitled Exiled. And also joining us earlier was Intifad Kanbar, director of the Washington office of the Iraqi National Congress. Thank you so much. You can continue this conversation online. All you have to do is go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.